Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. In this episode, I'm joined by returning guest Tara Edwards, a writer, editor, and Twitch streamer based in Ohio, known for her work in the digital media landscape. Today's deep dive focuses on the Matrix franchise. In this conversation, we unpack the creative ramifications of transforming a story into a franchise, our personal highlights and critiques of the films, and the timely nature of its central themes in the era of artificial intelligence. Side by Side is now available on all major listening platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Amazon Music. Give us a like and leave us a review if you find value in our conversations. All our content is available at sidebysidepodcast.podbean.com. And if you'd like to connect with me, please visit www.robertkwonhome.com. Well, how is the old inspiration? Has it been showing its face lately? Sometimes that happens to me when we kind of get into deep diving storytelling analysis and just looking at stuff that we enjoy, even though it's a very tricky time to be looking at entertainment storytelling anyway. Does it spark inspiration for you?
I walked away from the dinner feeling like my idea of a trauma analysis of media as a concept is not goofy as I thought it was, and is actually a decent idea for a book.
Like processing or analyzing trauma healing using like story and things like that?
Yeah. But basically, because during the conversation, and I did preface this example by saying, and it sucks because I hate her now, but trauma is a little bit like, or at least the concept of trauma mastery is a little bit like the Bogarts in Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that turn into your deepest fear. And then you learn the spell to basically render them harmless.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used that example, and she was like, now I understand way more about what you're getting at with this concept of triggers, right? Like the whole so Freud, which whatever, had this theory that it shows up a lot in trauma studies now, that like once you've been or experienced some type of trauma, you will kind of end up in a repetitive pattern where you constantly end up in situations that resemble that original trauma, but you're now trying to conquer it in a way that you couldn't before.
Yeah.
And that's the Bogart. And when I first explained it just in like regular terms, she thought I was saying like, you get stuck in a loop and you just keep looping and you keep dragging yourself down. But it's like, no, what you're doing, or the purpose of like trauma therapy, is to learn the spell to render triggers into a balloon that like pops, or whoopee cushion, or Snape in a mother's suit.
Yeah, it's like the trigger is still there, but in some ways it's no longer affecting you the same way. You can sort of just like be with it, or it's just something that happens. Yeah, I hear you on that one. I think in many ways why I was like, let's keep diving into things that fascinate us as far as like storytelling and things like that, is because I'm also very much looking for that inspiration and my why, as you know. But something like processing healing or processing trauma using story is like right up my alley. We could literally do a whole boring ass show about In Treatment, but no one would listen to it because I don't know, like no one watched it. But it's like, that's the stuff that like I would get nerdy over, and same to you.
And Paul's still not a great therapist.
No, well, that's the other thing. I was like, we could deep dive on like what kind of a therapist are we showing here for dramatic tension? But no, seriously, though, I'm just like, who's going to listen to it? Like, except for me. But today we are talking about something that we both have enjoyed and loved growing up, I believe. And it's really interesting to be talking about it now, almost like almost 25 years later, a quarter of a century later, and explore some of the things with the passage of time too, which is The Matrix. And now it includes a fourth film, which when I was talking to you about it, I was like, you know what? The fact that there is a fourth film now really complicates some of the themes and the things that we would want to talk about. So I think it's an interesting update edition of something that people have been dissecting forever now.
I actually don't think it does. I think the fourth film is just goofy. Yeah. So
it's goofy.
I don't think
I can't wait to get into it. Well, I think if we were talking about like the behind the scenes of how that movie even happened, it to me it's a little bit Black Mirror, which I think is like the irony of it, of why that movie even exists. But we can go into that a little bit later. I will say though, would you say the first movie remains the best of the four? And actually there are spinoffs and other things too, but
yeah. It's just because there are so many, like, I keep using the word goofy today. I don't know why. But like, there's just so many silly ass scenes in the third and the fourth film.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, it's just like clear that they're not even taking themselves seriously anymore. Like, to me, the first film is a serious, everybody took it seriously, let's do our jobs well. And the fourth film was like, everybody got together to do a fourth film and everybody was just there to have a good time.
Yeah, I think they try to infuse a story with self-awareness, I'll say, but at every turn, it sort of is constantly limited by the way that it's constricted as a franchise and by the studios and all of that. They definitely tried to be tongue-in-cheek about it, but didn't make the fourth film more substantive. I'm not sure. And I think that's kind of the tragedy of these franchises where, like, for example, the Barbie movie, we both recently saw that. But now Mattel has announced, like, they're going to try to do that with all of their toys. And immediately it becomes a different thing than kind of this, like, special moment. And I felt like that kind of happened with The Matrix because it was, like, 4 years later that they even decided to do a second and third film. But so maybe we can start with the first one, all the way back in 1999, I believe. What was it? Do you remember your impression or like what you thought about The Matrix at the time as it was like becoming introduced?
It was just kind of cool.
Yeah.
It was just kind of cool. Like I specifically remember that, this was around the time where you could like pay-per-view movies, where you could order a movie through your cable company, and then you could watch that movie on your like cable boxes in your house for like 24 hours or whatever. And so at some point, The Matrix was on in every room of the house for like the weekend that it was available on pay-per-view. And I just remember thinking that the subway fight with Neo and Smith was really cool.
Yeah.
And that's, as a 9-year-old, that's all that's all I have for you.
Okay, so my memory of The Matrix was just them talking about the technological advancements that the movie had on the film industry as a whole. And that part always captured my attention because, you know, when you're kind of seeing the promos and the trailers on TV and stuff, they're showing you this movie that, you know, definitely has a lot of substance, a lot of philosophical exploration, but they had a decent amount of really kick-ass fight scenes, which I felt like was just like the right flavor to entice different audiences. And it's been interesting to see like the impact it had on like cinema as a whole. But the reason why I talk about that partially is because it wasn't something I really understood until I was older, personally. But that The Matrix, similar to some other films that had a great impact, has been particularly influenced by Eastern animation, Japanese animation, and particularly like films like Ghost in the Shell, which explores very similar kind of that dystopian idea of man and machine. So I don't know. Looking back, I wonder if that style and that aesthetic really attracted me to it as well, because there was something about it that later on I think has to do with that. Its styling is very like Hong Kong action movie, very Japanese animation, and things like that. So like personally, I remember, I see now that I was like, oh yeah, and it was very cool. And part of that cool factor came from places like Japan.
And you know who else loves kung fu movies? Black people. And so you know that Black people will be the first people to hype this movie, because we had a main character who was fucking cool and could fight and was, you know, the gatekeeper of knowledge. It's like that classic joke about red pillars, right? It's like, you guys would never listen to a woman and a Black man tell you that everything you think about the world is incorrect.
Listen, that would have been, and you know, I know a little bit of production history with this one because it's been talked about, but like Will Smith was almost going to be Neo, which would have made it like him, Morpheus, and Trinity. I mean, in some ways we say now that film was, at least I say it, it was kind of ahead of its time without meaning to, with casting, the way that it like created these characters, particularly when we get to like the real world, right? It had this effortless coolness to it, I think in part because of that. Things that we make to be such problems these days. But it was like, I don't know, at the time, I guess no one questioned it. At least I didn't see that. Like no one took an issue that, to me, that they saw that the casting was just so spicy or something. It was just sort of like, we accepted it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we were in this weird period of the late 90s and early 2000s where diversity happened kind of naturally. Like people wanted to see, like there wasn't this whole sort of activism push for diversity yet. Well, there was, but it wasn't like mainstream because social media still wasn't a thing really yet. So any sort of diversity kind of happened organically. And I think I'm glad that Will Smith was not cast in this. One, because I feel like he would have ruined it, because he doesn't play dumb well. Like it comes off as like humorous, where I think Keanu Reeves can really dive into the, I have no idea what's going on and you believe it. Whereas like Will Smith, I have no idea what's going on in iRobot and it's hilarious. So I think he would have ruined it. And on top of that, I feel like the message of this cisgender, heterosexual white man having to listen and learn from marginalized groups, that message would have been lost, I think, if it hadn't been Keanu Reeves.
I definitely agree with that, because what you're saying is like, for better or worse, meaning one way or another, Will Smith would have received certain perceptions about the story. And it's funny, I do think Keanu Reeves as like the avatar for us, for the audience, right, seems to really work for the Matrix, on top of which he was just amazing as like an action star in the Matrix to begin with. And like, yeah.
Yeah. To be fair, I should say white-coded. He is not fully white. He does have Asian ancestry, so I don't want to like shade him in that regard, but he still looks white. He is coded as a white man, so.
Yeah, it's giving Joseph Gordon-Levitt for sure. Yeah. But another thing, just staying on this movie, because looking back is very interesting, because I definitely didn't think about this when I was a kid watching The Matrix. But we now understand the creators behind The Matrix, the Wachowskis, because of their identity. Looking back at the film, you see that it can be recontextualized in a whole other way. And I kind of love that, just as a matter of like someone who likes analyzing these things, to see how much of a difference a different context could make. like, there's just so many things we saw, right, of like the movie being like kind of transcoded or actually really looking at dismantling the binary thinking in many ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you really do see that. I rewatched the first half of the movie last night out of just because I wanted to, because I actually know the film very well. I can quote it a lot. And the concept of the Matrix as this construct of society created for maximum desensitization is such a queer story. Like, you would basically, to come into your queer identity is to recognize the structure or society at hand wants you to be asleep. And that, like, sleep metaphor of people just sleepwalking through life is so queer coded in that regard.
Yeah. And just the metaphor of someone waking up once they've been exposed to a certain way of looking at society and why it's made and the power structures. I didn't think about it then, but since having come out as a queer person, there's so many aspects of that movie. I think the reason why it resonates with so many people is because we relate to the feeling of being, having our humanity oppressed or kind of being made to be boxed in and put on a mask for society, and how it deeply impacts us over time. So I think that's a very universal story that doesn't have to be a queer story, but at the same time, mm-hmm. my hope is that it can also be a place where people can see that we often experience very similar things, even if we're at opposite ends and whatnot. And then on top of that, I just thought it made me laugh going back to watch the movie, because we were talking about how every character on that ship, I think it was a Merovingian or whatever, like every character's name was like Tank.
Nebuchadnezzar is the name of the ship.
Thank you. Nebuchadnezzar. And like every person was like Tank, Switch, Cypher. And we were like, these are all trans names. These are all.
Yes. These are all trans names. And I will die on the hill that every person who is trans and goes through major surgery should be woken up from anesthesia with "Welcome to the Real World."
It's so funny you were telling me that recently, and I was like, that's such an accurate metaphor for when you go through something like that, where there's like, you come out and there's kind of like no going back in many ways. And actually, if you're comfortable discussing it, I really am curious. You now identify as ace, which has happened over the course of a few years recently. And like before, I think it was more of a journey for you. Is that experience similar to what you feel like something like The Matrix and these stories evoked, like from your personal experience?
I think it's a little bit different because the asexual identity is kind of a negation of something. Which makes it tricky and hard for most people to understand. If I had to use a Matrix metaphor, it's, you know, they had a rule of not unlocking or freeing minds over a certain age because they can't handle the life outside of the system. And I think for a lot of people, even people who are queer, to hear the concept of someone saying, I experience very little or no sexual attraction, their immediate thought is there's just no way that that exists, especially if they're not ace. And so to me, it's less of a Matrix situation and more of a being born in Zion and hearing about the Matrix and realizing there are all these people around you who were born in this totally other world you have never visited and never woken up in and will likely never experience.
Oh, that's so interesting. I wouldn't have looked at it that way, but as you're describing it, I was always fascinated by the characters who were born outside of the Matrix. And so, like, you know, they can't be plugged in, right? They don't have the their body isn't created for that, right? And in some ways, it would be interesting to explore a character, and maybe they did that with like the animated shorts and stuff, but like to explore characters who can't be plugged into the Matrix, can only hear about its impact and its history. Yeah, it has such a outsider looking in type of perspective, whereas like Neo, I think so many people attach to a character like Neo because his development is sort of like he can encompass it all. He sees the code and he can be in the real world, and he's sort of almost like, the more he grows as a character, he's almost like capable of everything. But it's very interesting to look at all the other side characters for that same reason, to be like, well, that's not going to be their life. You know, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought of it that way.
And to me, the whole negation aspect of asexuality really is like an outsider looking in, because so much of society is allosexual and allosexual coded. So we are constantly outsiders looking in, trying to figure out like what is. I think the most fun I've had as an asexual is a group of asexuals trying to describe what flirting is. Because truthfully, none of us have any fucking idea. And me realizing that even I, someone who considers myself to be an excellent at flirting, like I realize I don't even know what it really is. And I've often been very confused. And I think for allosexuals, that line is so much more clear, because you experience sexual attraction or you don't, but it's not like a thing that you have to, you know, sort of dream up, aka you've been to the Matrix. You know what the Matrix is and tastes like. You know what Tasty Wheat tasted like. How do the machines though? I love Mouse's stupid asides, but basically, yeah, that's what being ace is like, if I was to use a Matrix metaphor.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, what are some of the other things that you feel like is still holds up or relevant today? For example, like one thing I thought about looking back after almost like 25 years at the Matrix, do we feel like technology, like is our relationship to technology and humans, is it still something we should be worried about? Like it made me think about that, you know? But yeah, do you think there are things about the movie that's like to you is just still very much relevant today like that?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned like the idea of hostile technology, because AI is literally what they call the machines, or what literally what Morpheus says when he's explaining what happened. And the thing about it is AI, as we call it today, is not that. It's not artificial intelligence. What we have is the stuff right before AI, actually. We're just calling it AI. Because these technologies, they're just mining information and summarizing it faster than humans can. They're not actually thinking. Like, we still don't have a technology that can pass the Alan Turing test. So, like, we're not there yet, despite all of the, you know, panic and also overhype, because a lot of these technologies also don't work. Like, as we see with people trying to use ChatGPT to do all these functions, they are flawed. Actually, our favorite person, ContraPoints, did a wonderful tangent about AI where she got around AI's safeguards around sex and pornography by inputting certain, you know, buzzwords, and also, you know, can trick AI to how to teach you to make a bomb. So like, again, these things are not as they seem. Also plugging Dan Olsen's video about the metaverse, because it's not, it's a lot of overhype and a lot of people saying things that aren't really true yet. But I do think we'll get there. I just don't know that it's at the speed that these tech people are saying. As far as fear of hostility, I think that is a sign of white supremacy, in the same way that white supremacists are very afraid of aliens, because it immediately reminds them that they, at any given time, they could become the minority. And when you think about the diversity of the Matrix and Zion, it's not surprising that there are a lot of Black and Brown and Asian characters who are in power, because they've had to deal with marginalization before. So they can outsmart and have the sort of tenacity to deal with the, you know, this whole new world. Whereas like white people would be the most panicky, unsettled, unable to cope with this new world order.
So you're saying like the Matrix, when you wake up for the Matrix as a metaphor, that it can be a metaphor for decolonization, or basically decolonizing the mind. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's so interesting. And again, I'm like, Wachowskis, what is your story? Like, where did this even come from that you're just like, this is like, there are so many filters that we use on a day to day, taking outside of this story that I love. It's like thinking of things that could get a bunch of funding from studios, that something like this could like go through that system, is, I still think it's pretty remarkable, because it still appears to be a difficult thing to achieve right now, to have a story just allow itself to be. Yeah, for me, I think with technology, I find it interesting that there's like this energy around people who's very much excited and trying to create the Matrix, basically, when you talk about metaverse. So in other words, here is like where the machines would live, and we're trying to create like the Matrix where the people are asleep. And then at the same time, the Matrix is often used as a metaphor for like, oh, this here is a simulation. You know, it's not like us doing things and we're trying to create the Matrix, but actually this is the Matrix. I find the fact that the movie can kind of address both or look at both, and people take away from it different things, to be like very fascinating. Because right now, like you said, with the advancement of AI, what we're calling it, is bringing up all these questions yet again, and people taking all sides and having very heated discussions. Yeah, in some ways, I wonder if that's what made me or us think about the Matrix again. I'm just like, oh, here we go, having the same conversation as we did right around when the first Matrix came around, because we had the Y2K fears, and we're kind of having kind of similar discussions as that time. Like, do you remember the Y2K scare? And people are like,
yeah, the thought that like at midnight, when the year crossed into the year 2000, that all the computers and all the machines would cut off and we'd end up in like mayhem and chaos or whatever.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, little did we know, the mayhem and chaos would be caused by a microscopic virus in 2020.
Right. You know, it's funny how the world turns. But yeah, I think in some ways it's interesting hearing how the Matrix is still being addressed, I guess is my point, for people who are very into tech and wanting to push tech to the furthest extremes. And then also for people who are like, this is a cautionary tale, and will cite the Matrix. And like, even in like spiritual circles, people will use, oh, I, you know, being plugged into the Matrix or being red-pilled as like a thing to describe a certain type of experience. It's kind of nice to have something like the Matrix to be able to summarize that, and you don't have to try to explain something that's very existential. Okay, I am curious though. So you're not as fond of the second, third, fourth movies. Do you want to say more about it?
Yeah, sure. I would say the first two films are great. The second film really gets going and is perfect right up until the last act. Then it's like We know you needed a third film. So, sure. Mm-hmm. 'cause the cliffhanger, and I think also, and this is why 3 and 4 are so is because I think that they're playing around with technological ideas that are also somewhat magical, and they can't really make the distinctions like smartly enough for it to work, right, because they haven't really thought these things out, right? Because Neo's abilities outside of the Matrix have to have some sort of magical component, right? Why is this human man capable of seeing code outside of the Matrix, right? And the only explanation is some sort of magical intervention. And you have that as well with the concept of him being the one, aka his DNA was coded in some kind of way to make him capable of these otherworldly human things. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that they ever really grapple hard enough with those distinctions. So it makes things convoluted and hard to follow. But I think the first two films are really great. And I want to shout out my favorite action sequence of all time, ride or die forever, for the car scene from The Matrix Reloaded.
Listen, like, I love The Matrix Reloaded actually for that reason, because they were just like, we have a bigger budget, let's use it. And I was like, yes, ma'am. I mean, there's some stuff in there that I think still looks pretty decent for today, even. And I think, like,
yeah, it doesn't
have a hard time pulling
all
it off today.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they even built like a little mini section of a highway. Again, just the way that productions are being like factorized these days. Some of these like creative decisions, I don't know that they could have happened, just a sheer like scale of what they were trying to accomplish. But I definitely agree with, in particular, the ending of Matrix Reloaded. I was watching some videos of like Easter egg on the Matrix, right? Just for to prep for the conversation. And there's this one part that's like very commonly being like, yeah, we can sort of like analyze and point to what we think is likely, like what they were going for. But I think the ending of Neo being able to stop the machines in the real world was very much like, felt like a studio decision to loop mm-hmm. it to the third film when they release it, because they were like trying to explain, they're like, this is the one part that doesn't make much sense. If you try to follow like the rules that they were establishing, it doesn't mm-hmm. make sense for Neo to be able to have the same abilities outside of the Matrix when he's not plugged in. And then in the third movie, after he collapses from doing that for the first time, his consciousness, somehow he's back in that like train station. That's like the in-between, mm-hmm. like purgatory.
Yeah.
And they were like, they didn't really explain how that happened or why that happened. And then somehow Neo's consciousness resets back at this other place that was just introduced in the movie. So,
yeah. And that's what I mean. And that's what I meant by the failures of the third and fourth film, is that they don't grapple with that otherworldly ability, aka Neo having powers outside of the Matrix. And in the first film, they explain it so well. It's like, if the Matrix is a program, theoretically, human imagination means you can program anything into the Matrix and make it work. And that is how they're able to jump from buildings and, you know, do all this crazy stuff. Neo can fly. But in the real world, it's like, how? And they never explain it. And they never really grapple with it. They're just like, just go with it. Just go with it. And that's why it doesn't work.
Yeah. From that perspective, story-wise, the fourth film also really, like, it just adds to the confusion somewhat, mm-hmm. because again, a lot of the confusion has to do with like, what is Neo? They're saying, it's almost like the franchise kind of saying he is the one, but also there is no one. And like, they're trying to say both at the same time, which could work if you're really trying to do that. But like most stories, I feel like really struggle with it. Lost tried to do it. It made no sense. Apologies for Lost fans. I love Lost, but it doesn't make sense. So,
And you know what else happened with Lost? The strike.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's right, because it was like season 4 of Grey's, which is how I track the chronology.
Heroes season two.
Yeah. A little bit of like media context. It was right around then that we got the Jersey Shores and like the reality TV boom. So if you think what's happening right now is not going to affect everything, the last time this happened, a lot of shit went down that we are still seeing today. I think that's a very valid critique of something that I really personally enjoy. But like in the fourth film, Trinity becomes the one. They flip the narrative. It mirrors the original story, but it felt like they were trying to fix like the Trinity problem of having like, what is that word? Like a perfect female character, but it's all in service of the...
AKA Manic Pixie Dream Girl Syndrome. And also not passing the Bechdel test, because Trinity is just kind of like her thing is that she's just made to love Neo, and that's it.
They clearly tried to address it. Like, it felt like the fourth one was like, well, if we were to make this film that no one wants to make, we can try to address some of the things that people have been talking about for like 15 years. And one of them was like Trinity's role. But within the rules they made, I was sort of like, I think that the overall story theme is about love. Love conquers all. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But I there is a part of me that I can't let go, because they spent so much time establishing the world of just like, what was it about taking her out of the Matrix now that she was plugged in again, that she became the one? I just could not follow it. And I think it was sort of like, it had to happen. Like, the story needed it, so they made it happen.
And again, I'm just going to keep going back to them not really acknowledging their own magic that they injected into the franchise when they gave Neo magical powers. Because that's what they are in the real world. They're magical powers.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, you know what the fourth movie reminds me of? Madoka Magica.
You mean like when they made like the later like movie?
No, it reminds me of the concept from Madoka Magica, which is that the humans' magical girls are specifically being harvested for energy, because they found that human teenage girls experience the height of their, you know, power potential when they're teenage girls. And that kind of mirrors the fourth film's idea about how when you give humans choice is when they experience, or, you know, export the most power to the Matrix.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I love Madoka Magica, but I think you're right in the Matrix franchise trying to explore these themes. And then the longer it goes, the more... the looser it feels, I guess we can say that. Although I think, you know, I always appreciate like the themes they still try to evoke, I suppose.
Yeah, I still like, you know, love conquers all. I think we can always all get behind that. Shout out to Bell Hooks and her trilogy on love. We could all do with some more loving in society, so that will never be a wrong choice. But I do feel like the fourth movie was just, we all enjoyed working together, let's have a good time, and we're not going to worry about trying to make this like, you know, super serious perfect explanation of things. We're just gonna do so, we're just gonna try to make what we can do out of mess.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think in many ways, a lot of the public, like, that's what I think as time has gone on, the audience has gotten smarter as well. So they're able to, quote unquote, see the production behind the movie in some ways, the way that we talk about it. So it doesn't have the same impact as like the first Blair Witch Project. That's not going to happen again, you know.
You know. Even though found footage is still... like, there were 8 record movies, so, or REC movies, I think. And how many, what's the other one? The one where it's like...
Paranormal Activity?
Yes. So, and that had, what, 4 films?
I think there's been more now. They just keep changing subtitles now, so you can't keep track.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, like, found footage, security footage, I think what we're witnessing from an industry perspective is what happens when capitalism takes over creativity. And this was happening a little bit when we were in college together, where you had a shift from studios having actual creatives running their studios into just hiring business people to run things. And business people only see numbers and returns on investment. So what this leads to is a shrinking situation where the average decent spec script goes in the trash in favor of a adaptation that already has a huge fan base, i.e. a Hunger Games, a Harry Potter, a Twilight.
Yeah.
A Divergent, which...
I saw the first one in theaters, I have to admit. And I think the last one, yeah, they didn't even have a theatrical release for it, which is, I'm just like, that's wild that...
Yeah, they didn't. Like, because, yeah.
But all that money was already sunk into it, too. That's just wild to me. But I think what Tara's alluding to is, you know, the industry is going through its own kind of like identity crisis in some ways. And
the machines have taken over Hollywood.
And, you know,
and Zion are the writers and actors on strike.
With that being said, be a Neo or a Trinity.
And Neo is Fran Drescher.
The most unlikely... The one we did not see coming. I had no idea Fred was head of the union. Like, who knew? Okay, is there anything else you want to say to sort of wrap up kind of our little deep dive of this Matrix franchise?
I just want to list things that were fucking cool. Morpheus's glasses not having frames, fucking cool. Morpheus, fucking cool. Morpheus saying to Neo, do you think that's air you're breathing? Fucking cool. The car scene, the twins, fucking cool. The twins saying, we are getting aggravated. Yes, we are. No notes. Perfect line. Endlessly quotable. I just can't, like,
yeah.
We are getting aggravated. Yes, we are.
No, you're right, though. Their writing is very much like queens of one-liners in some ways. I'm so quotable, right? And it's not like every script, yeah, is like that or has to be that, but yeah, iconic lines. And I will leave with my favorite thing about people finding metaphors for the Matrix, right? That the Merovingian is like an old operating system. So I just saw a video of people kept calling that French guy Windows Vista. Windows Vista, the character. Just like an outdated, yes, OS that, perfect, no one wants to deal with, that didn't work that well, and is somehow still persisting, giving us issues.
Yes. Yes. Windows Vista is him. We got to talk about the Oracle, though. We can't leave without talking about,
okay, the Oracle. Let's talk about the Oracle.
First of all, the fact that the Oracle is a black woman. Let's sit with that. Let's marinate on that. Like,
all iterations, by the way. They could have not chosen that, yes, but they were like, who is someone that people will listen to with wisdom? What is emblematic of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, very much so. Also, another person with like every line, kind of like Dumbledore, just like you, just like eating up everything they're saying, mm-hmm, like that character for me.
Yeah. What's really going to cook your noodle later is, would you have still knocked it over if I hadn't said anything? That was so. And then she's just like, I love candy. Girl, what?
I'm sorry. Now you just got me thinking about Scary Movie 3 with Queen Latifah as like the Oracle just having a fight with that, yes, ring.
But on a serious note, I just wanted to say, like, for me, I love the concept of the Oracle and the Architect being a black man or a black woman and a white man having to come to an understanding about the system.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you project that onto, like, current society, right? And we talk about this all the time in the black community, that, like, black women who marry and date white men, their relationships are so different than the relationships between Black men and white women. And I think it's because Black women entering these relationships end up basically showing the white man their power and privilege will always exist, even when they're in a relationship with them, and that a Black woman's power and privilege will always be disadvantaged, even when they're that close to privilege. And I think that kind of mirrors this, you know, the Oracle and the Architect in the Reloaded franchise, is that the Oracle teaches the Architect basically their power and privilege can always change on a dime.
Immediately, I was like, I would watch a play, a twofer, between the Architect and the Oracle. Because that's another thing where they introduced the Analyst in the fourth one. I was like, I get what you're saying, but I miss the Architect and the Oracle. And there were two characters that I was always like, they need to have more lines. But I also know why they're holding back, because if they did that, it would just kind of like unwrap the entire universe, almost having these two characters mm-hmm. parse it out. Yeah, I've never thought about it, just the avatars that they would have chosen, right? A white man and a Black woman. But that's very interesting. Dang, analysis.
She was
one of my favorites.
Also, who is the Oracle's protector? An Asian man.
I loved him. I was like, we all need one of him. Shoot, I can't remember his name now, but I love that guy. A really, really well-known like action star too from Asia.
He's somebody's son.
But in any case, y'all should just like check out The Matrix for the action sequences too. That's all I'm saying. Because they put in the work. It was ridiculous that they wanted them to do that 25 years later. What were they expecting?
Oh man, I could talk about that action sequence for hours. Just like, it builds and releases tension so well, and fucking Morpheus getting on top of a truck with a samurai sword fighting an agent. Morpheus using a seatbelt as a weapon is very Avatar The Last Airbender, because Aang's whole thing is using the environment to his advantage. So Morpheus just like whipping the seatbelt out creatively, just chef's kiss.
Now I want to rewatch Reloaded, because I actually didn't do that. But yeah, that was always one of my favorites to put on, because the action sequences are just like chef's kiss. They're so good. Well, thank you, Tara, for spending time with me as usual. I hope we get to record many more, especially since I feel more confident in editing. I appreciate your time, and thank you for keeping my inner child spirit alive with all of these stories and looking at them.
Thank you for letting me talk about stupid jokes like telling every trans person when they wake up from surgery, welcome to the real world.